Namo tassa bhagavato arahato samma sambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato samma sambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato samma sambuddhassa. Okay, today we will be studying Sutta number 95 of the Majjhima Nikaya. This is called the Chanki Sutta. In Pali, the C, it's pronounced like CH. And this sutta is, in a sense, almost continuous with the Vimangsaka Sutta, the sutta that we discussed last time. It deals with a similar theme, and that is how one is to validate the teaching for oneself. But here the subject is dealt with in somewhat greater detail, and it's set within a quite interesting and charming scenario which gives us some insight into the living context in which the Buddha lived, taught, and established his teaching. If you remember the sutta we took last week, the Vimangsaka Sutta, the Buddha discusses how a disciple should investigate the Tathagata, the Buddha, to ascertain whether he is worthy of trust, worthy of confidence. Then when he determines that the Buddha is worthy of confidence, he approaches him to hear the Dhamma, and then he practices, gains some realization, and then is able to assert his confidence as a matter of direct personal experience. So here we will see a similar process unfold, but with more attention to the stages leading up to this realization. Okay, so coming to the beginning of the sutta opens when the Buddha has been wandering in the Kosala country, the land of Kosala. That's in the far north of India, together with a large company of monks. And he eventually arrives at a Brahmin village named Opasada. And here the Buddha, together with the monks, they stay in a place called the God's Grove, which is a grove of sala trees to the north of the town. Okay, now on this occasion, there was a Brahmin by the name of Chanki who was ruling over this village of Opasada and all of the adjoining land. And this property had been given to him as a sacred grant by King Pasenadi of Kosala. King Pasenadi was the king of the kingdom of Kosala, and he gave this land as a gift, a special gift to the Brahmin. And now this was a common practice in India during this period, that kings would depend upon the Brahmins to perform their religious services for them, to conduct the ceremonies, rituals, even sacrifices in accordance with the Brahminic teaching, the Vedas. The performance of these rituals and sacrifices were, in the views of the kings, essential to secure stability in their kingdom, to ensure a good harvest, to ensure victory in the battle with their enemies. And so they became a kind of symbiotic relationship developed between royalty and the Brahmins, whereby the Brahmins would perform services for royalty, for kings and princes, and the kings, to express their gratitude, would make lavish offerings of money to the Brahmins, and towards some especially esteemed, learned Brahmins, they would make gifts of even quite expensive pieces of property. And so the Brahmin Chunky was now ruling over this whole village with all of its adjoining lands, which was considered crown property. And so when the Buddha and his monks arrive, then word goes around that the ascetic, the recluse Gotama, has arrived in this village. Then the rest of this passage that's omitted here is the same as passages we've come across earlier. Word gets around that the Buddha has arrived. He's said to be an arahant, perfectly enlightened one, so on and so forth. And so they decide to go to see the Buddha. And so a large number of the Brahmin householders set out in groups and bands, heading northwards to the solitary grove where the Buddha is staying. And just as they were doing so, the Brahmin Chunky, who was the lord of this region, was staying in the upper story of his palace for his midday rest. And then he saw the Brahmin householders setting out from Upasada in groups and bands. And then he sent an inquiry to find out why they were going towards the north of the city, north of the village. And the reply came to him that the ascetic Gotama, who's said to be a Buddha, a perfectly enlightened one, has arrived, and they are going to see this Master Gotama. And so the Brahmin then sends out a message to his minister. He asks the minister to go to the Brahmins and tell them to wait for him, that he will go also and join them on their trip to see the Buddha. Obviously, this Brahmin must have had, we call, good roots, since many of the Brahmins were actually envious of the ascetics, and they despised them and condemned them and scorned them. But this Brahmin would have naturally had some kind of respect for those who are leading a true ascetic life. And so when word comes, the word spreads out, that the Brahmin householders, when word spreads out that the Brahmin Chunky wants to go to see the Buddha, then there are 500 Brahmins from various states who would come to Upasada for some business or other. Actually, in the Buddhist text, when you come across the number 500, one shouldn't always take it too literally. The number 500 is often just used to indicate a very large number. Okay, so when word comes down to these 500 Brahmins that the Brahmin Chunky wants to go to see the Buddha, then they are appalled by this, and they think it's somewhat unfitting, maybe even disgraceful, for a high Brahmin to be going to see the one, especially who is the owner of the land, owner of the property, to be going to see this wandering ascetic. And so they come to him, and they ask him whether it's true that he does have this intention. And when he replies that it is true, then now coming to paragraph 8, they give him a long, extended argument, trying to explain the reasons why it is not fitting for him to go to see the recluse Gotama, but rather it would be proper and fitting for the recluse Gotama, for the Buddha, to come to see you. And this passage gives us, in a nutshell, the types of qualities that were considered to be the distinguishing marks of a respectable Brahmin. First, he must be well-born on both sides. That is, on the side of both his mother and father, of pure Brahminic descent going back 7 generations, that there should be no mixture of blood from any members of the lower classes in his family lineage. Also, in this case, this Brahmin Chunky is rich. He's been very amply rewarded for his services by the king, and so he has much wealth and great possessions. Then he is a master of the three Vedas. The Vedas are the sacred scriptures of Brahmanism. And in fact, all of Hinduism, right up to the present day, regards the Vedas as the supreme religious authority. The Vedas consist of hymns that were composed to various deities by the early Aryan settlers of India who would have come. Perhaps the origins of the Veda go back perhaps to 2000, as far back as 2000 BC. And these hymns and instructions for the sacrifices were compiled into these sacred scriptures, which there are actually three primary Vedas, and then the fourth Veda was added later. The three Vedas are called the Rig Veda, the Sama Veda, and the Yajur Veda. And the fourth one, which was added later, is called the Atharva Veda, which it said has a somewhat different character from the other three. And so the Brahmins memorized these scriptures. They taught them the scriptures to their pupils. They perform their rituals and sacrifices in accordance with the directions that came down in the Vedas. And they regarded the Vedas as a kind of divinely revealed truth. Okay, and so this Brahmin, like many of his contemporaries, was a master of the three Vedas, along with their vocabularies, liturgy, phonology, etymology, and the histories as a fifth. He was also skilled in philology, grammar, and in natural philosophy, and was called the marks of a great man. Then also this Brahmin is handsome, comely, and graceful. He is virtuous, mature in virtue. He is a good speaker, and he is the teacher of the teachers of many, that is, his pupils have now become respected and esteemed teachers in their own right. And he has 300 Brahmin students. And then he is honored, respected, revered, venerated, and esteemed by King Pasenadi of Kosala, the king who is also a devotee of the Buddha. And you are also honored, respected, esteemed by the Brahmin Pokarasati. This was another famous Brahmin of the period. And you, sir, rule over Opasada, a crown property abounding in living beings, a sacred grant given to you by King Pasenadi of Kosala. And since this is so, it is not proper for you to go to see this ascetic Gotama, who has no property, no wealth. It is proper for the recluse Gotama to come to see you. And it struck me that this entire, well, maybe I'll finish this passage first and then give my own reflections on this. Okay, now, when these Brahmins had finished their appeal to the Brahmin Chanki, he remained firm in his decision to go to see the Buddha. And now, in paragraph 9, he explains why. Why it is proper for him to go to see the Buddha, and why he should not wait there expecting the Buddha to come to see him. First, the recluse Gotama is well born on both sides, a pure maternal and paternal descent, seven generations back. Okay, this doesn't mean that the Buddha was from a Brahminic lineage. The Buddha was from another class called the Kshatriya caste. This was the caste of the warriors and administrators, the ruling caste. But both castes were regarded as the highly placed castes, and the others, the Vaishyas, the merchants and agriculturists, and the shudras, the laborers or menials, were regarded as lower classes. And in this period, there was a kind of rivalry between the Brahmins and the Kshatriyas. The Brahmins regarded themselves as superior, and the Kshatriyas as being one notch down, while the Kshatriyas, because they were the ones who held the power, the rulers, considered themselves to be superior, and the Brahmins to be subservient to themselves. But to some degree, they had a kind of mutual respect for each other, so their attitude towards one another was different from that of their attitude towards the Vaishyas and the Shudras, the mercantile class and the laboring class. Okay, so the Buddha is impeccable with respect to his aristocratic birth. And then the recluse Gotama went forth, that is, he left the household life, going into the homeless life, abandoning much gold and bullion stored away in vaults and depositories. According to the traditional story, the Buddha was the son of a king and was being groomed to be a king in his own turn. It's known with a fair degree of certainty that this story is not completely accurate, since the Sakyan Republic, the state where he lived, was not a kingship but a republic. But he would have come from the ruling family. His father might have been the president of a council of elders, a ruling council of elders, and so the family would have been very richly endowed with wealth and property. Then the ascetic, the recluse Gotama, went forth from the home life into homelessness while still young, a black-haired young man endowed with the blessings of youth. That is, he didn't go forth when he was an old person, unable to do any useful work, but while he was still strong, young, and healthy. And he went into the homeless life, even though his mother and father wished otherwise and were weeping with tearful faces. Then the recluse Gotama is handsome, comely, and graceful. He is virtuous with noble virtue, wholesome virtue, possessing wholesome virtue. He is a good speaker with good delivery. He is a teacher of the teachers of many. In these respects, he's similar to the Brahmin. But in the next respect, he's different, that the recluse Gotama is free from sensual lust and without personal vanity. He holds the doctrine of the moral efficacy of action, the doctrine of the moral efficacy of deeds. These would be two important qualities. Actually, they're just variations on one important quality for a Brahmin. That is, he accepts the principle of karma, the fact that actions have results in future life. In this way, he would have been quite different from some of the other ascetics who went about proclaiming some of the ideas that we read about in the earlier sutta, that there is no this world, no other world, no point in serving parents, no point in being helpful to others, no point in giving in charity. But the Buddha upholds the doctrine of karma and its fruit. And for this reason, the Brahmins, at least some of the Brahmins, respected him. Okay, some of the others I'll just skip over. Then people come from remote kingdoms and remote districts to question the ascetic, the recluse Gotama. And many thousands of deities have gone for refuge for life to the recluse Gotama. I have to say, I don't know how the Brahmin would be able to know that. And then a good report of the recluse Gotama has been spread to the effect that he is accomplished, that's an arahant, fully enlightened, perfect in true knowledge and conduct, and so forth. Then the recluse Gotama possesses the 32 marks of a great man. These are special features which are considered distinctive of, if a person is endowed with these 32 characteristics, 32 marks, it's said that he has two possible destinies open to him. One is that if he remains in the worldly life, he will become a universal monarch, somebody who will unify the whole world under his rule. But if he goes forth from the household life into homelessness, then he becomes a perfectly enlightened Buddha. And so when the Buddha was a young child, the seers or the sages of the kingdom inspected his body and they saw that he had these characteristics. And so they predicted to his father that he had two possible destinies, either to become a universal monarch or to become a Buddha. Okay, and then King Sainya Bimbisara, he was the king of Magadha, together with his family, have gone for refuge to the recluse Gotama. And King Pasenadi of Kosala, together with his family, have gone for refuge to the recluse Gotama. And even the Brahmin Pokarasati and his wife and children have gone for refuge, for life, to the recluse Gotama. And then the Brahmin gives another reason. He says that the recluse Gotama has arrived at Upasada and is staying in the grove to the north of the village, of the town. And so any recluses or Brahmins that come to our town are our guests, and guests should be honored, respected, revered, and venerated by us. This is a very important principle of Indian culture, particularly of Brahmanism, that the guest should always be regarded almost as a deity in human form. And so one has to make extensive measures to show special hospitality and consideration for one's guests. And so for all of these reasons, the Brahmin says, it is not proper for Master Gotama to come to see me, but rather it is proper for me to go to see Master Gotama. Then he says, this much is the praise of Master Gotama that I have learned, but the praise of Master Gotama is not limited to that, for the praise of Master Gotama is immeasurable. And since Master Gotama possesses each one of these factors, it is not proper for him to come to see me, but it is proper for me to go to see Master Gotama. So let us all go to see the recluse Gotama. Now what strikes me as interesting is that there seems to be almost no way that the compilers of the canon could have learned about this dialogue. So where does this dialogue come from? It seems to me that it was composed by the compilers of the canon as perhaps a way to give a cameo setting to the discussion that's going to take place. And once the discussion unfolds, we see that the Brahmin Chunky actually fades completely into the background. He doesn't really figure in the rest of the sutta at all. The sutta unfolds as a discussion between the Buddha and a young Brahmin who is supposed to be very skilled in debate and argumentation named Kapatika. So I think one could see it work here, maybe the literary skills of compilers of the canon to create a kind of contrast between the even the most high-ranking Brahmins and the Buddha as a shramana, a renunciant teacher who is outside the pale of the four classes of society, and yet for that reason is even more worthy of esteem and veneration than the Brahmins themselves. And in support of this, my thesis, we find another sutta in the Digha Nikaya. I think it's actually the sutta involving Pokhara Sati, in which exactly the same discussion takes place. And so it's like stock words which have been created in order to provide a dramatic setting for the unfolding of the sutta. And particularly when we come to this last paragraph which I just read, where he says that this much is the praise of Master Gotama that I have learned, but the praise of Master Gotama is not limited to that, for the praise of Master Gotama is immeasurable. I think it's upamana or upameya. So we could see almost the compilers of the canon are putting their own faith and devotion into that passage. Okay, so now the Brahmin Chunky, together with a large company of Brahmins, they go to the Buddha and they exchange greetings, and then they sit down to one side. And so now the Buddha is sitting, when they arrive, the Buddha is sitting there, and he's just concluded having some amiable talk with some very senior Brahmin. But at the time in this assembly, there was a young Brahmin student. His name was Kapattika. He was only 16 years old, but he was already a master of the Vedas. I think in the Brahmin society, they would begin training young Brahmins even from the age of, well, from the age when they begin speaking, they begin training them in the Vedas. The Vedas would not have been written down, they would have to be learned orally directly from a teacher. And so as soon as a young Brahmin, especially in the upper echelons of the educated Brahmins, as soon as he's able to speak and to understand spoken language, he will be taught the Brahmin hymns and trained to memorize them. Then as he grows older, he will be given explanations and learn the different branches of the Vedic science until a Brahmin, even 16 years old, could be a repository for a vast store of knowledge, of scriptural knowledge. And now while the elder Brahmins are conversing with the Buddha, this young Brahmin keeps on breaking in and interrupting their discussion. It seems he's so young, he's somewhat arrogant and disrespectful towards the others. And then the Buddha rebukes him, asks him not to keep on interrupting the talk, but to wait until the discussion is finished. But when the Buddha says this, then the Brahmin Chunky asks the Buddha not to rebuke this Brahmin student, Kapattika, since he is very learned, wise, and capable of taking part in the discussion. Okay, so then the Brahmin student thinks that he will try to catch the eye of the Buddha and then ask him a question. And the Buddha knows what is taking place in Kapattika's mind, and he turns his eye towards him. And then when he does so, then the Brahmin student poses his question. And here we start coming to what I would call the meaty part of the sutta. And the first, this question is intended by the Brahman Sudhakapatika to establish the authority, the validity of the Vedas. So he says, Master Gotama, in regard to the ancient Brahminic hymns that have come down through oral transmission in the scriptural collections. Actually, the word scriptural here is not quite appropriate, since scripture implies something that's written. The word used is pitaka sampada. So these are collections of sacred texts, but they are not scriptures in the sense of written texts, because they are the sacred texts of the Brahmins were always preserved and transmitted orally. They only came to be written down, I think, probably after the beginning of the Christian era. Okay, so with regard to these texts, the Brahmins come to a definite conclusion, a definite assertion. Only this is true. Anything else is wrong. What does Master Gotama say about this? Okay, this young Brahman is now trying to establish the, you call the dogmatic authority of these scriptures. So he's not advancing this viewpoint as his own, but the fact that he's appealing to the Brahmins, and he's a Brahmin himself, shows, or at least implies, that this is really his own point of view. And now the Buddha asks a counter question. He doesn't give a direct answer, but he poses a counter question. He says, how then, Bharadvaja? And Bharadvaja, this would be the same as Kapatika. Kapatika might be his personal name, Bharadvaja, his family name. So how then, Bharadvaja, among the Brahmins, is there even a single Brahmin who says thus, I know this, I see this, only this is true, anything else is wrong? And Kapatika has to admit, no, that there are no Brahmins that he knows, that he has studied with, who are able to say that they see for themselves the truth of the Vedas, that they know that the Vedic teaching is true. Then the Buddha asks, among the Brahmins, is there even a single teacher or a single teacher's teacher back to seven generations of teachers who says thus, I know this, I see this, only this is true, anything else is wrong? And Kapatika, now his face must be getting red, and he must be getting somewhat flustered and agitated, but he has to admit, no, Master Gotama. Then the Buddha asks, how then the ancient Brahmin seers, these are what they call the rishis, the sages of ancient times, the ones who composed these hymns, the hymns here are the hymns of the Vedas, whose ancient hymns that were formerly chanted, uttered, and compiled, the Brahmins nowadays still chant and repeat. Then Buddha mentions the name of the ancient seers who were mentioned in the Vedas. Did even these ancient Brahmin seers say this? We know this, we see this, only this is true, anything else is wrong. And now, with even greater shame, greater embarrassment, greater reluctance, Kapatika has to admit, no, Master Gotama. And so now the Buddha sums up and says, it seems that among the Brahmins, there is not even a single Brahmin who says thus, I know this, I see this, only this is true, anything else is wrong. So even though this seems to be referring to things that happened thousands of years ago, but still we find many religious adherents today of different religions pointing to their own scriptures and saying, it says this in the Bible, the Quran, the Vedas, even the Tripitaka, and because it says this, this must be true, only this is true, anything else is wrong. And sometimes some adherents will say, throughout history they've said, if you don't believe that this is true, off with your head, or you go to the stake and burn. It's not a laughing matter. It happened in the Inquisition, and various religious wars have been fought. Yeah. I have to say I find it puzzling too. It's a good question. I have to say I'm not really capable of answering that because I don't know enough about how the Vedas are reputed to have come into being. But I think the view of the Orthodox Brahmins is that the Vedas were actually somehow divinely revealed to the seers in moments of inspiration. They were a kind of outpouring of the divine power, Brahma, into the minds, directly into the minds of the ancient rishis. And then the rishis received this inspiration from the divine power of Brahma and then composed the Vedas based on that divine inspiration. But when we think that the rishis would have claimed to have directly known and seen the truth of the Vedas for themselves, it's a point that maybe merits research. Okay, so the Buddha then draws the conclusion that it seems that there's not a Brahmin. There's not even a single Brahmin who can say, I know this, I see this, only this is true, anything else is wrong. Okay, going back seven generations and then going back to the ancient Brahmin rishis who created and composed the hymn. Then the Buddha uses a simile, famous simile of the file of blind men. And you have this line of blind men. The ones in the back are blind, the ones in the front are blind, the ones in the middle are blind, the ones in the back are blind. And yet they're walking along, trying to reach their destination, depending upon the one in the front. And so the ones in the back think, we must be going in the right direction, since the one in front of me is leading me in that direction. And the one in front of him thinks, well, I must be going in the right direction, since the one in front of me is going in the right direction. And so this goes up to the first one, but the first one being blind and with nobody to guide him might be moving in the wrong direction without realizing it. There's a famous painting, I think, by Bruegel, Dutch painter Bruegel, called The Line of Blind Men, which is almost like a perfect illustration for the simile. And so then the Buddha says, and so in regard to their statement, the Brahmins seem to be like a file of blind men. The first one does not see, the middle one does not see, and the last one does not see. In Now, before we go further, I want to refer to another sutta which helps to, again, to shed some light upon the Buddha's position in relation to the different groups of spiritual teachers of this period. We go to Sutta 100, paragraphs 6 and 7. This is on page 820. Here the Buddha is in dialogue with another Brahmin youth whose name is Sangarava. Sangarava. And this Brahmin youth poses the question to the Buddha. He says, there are some recluses and ascetics who claim to teach the fundamentals of the holy life after having reached the consummation and perfection of direct knowledge here and now. Where among these recluses and Brahmins does Master Gotama stand? And then the Buddha says, among these recluses and Brahmins who claim to teach the fundamentals of the holy life after having reached the consummation and perfection of direct knowledge here and now, I say there is a diversity among them. There are some recluses and Brahmins who are traditionalists. The traditionalists, these would be called anusavikas. Okay, so there are some recluses and Brahmins who are traditionalists. That is, they rely upon an oral transmission or oral tradition to teach the fundamentals of the holy life. I have to say, I find the expression been added here, after having reached the consummation perfection of direct knowledge here and now, it's somewhat puzzling, since if they have direct knowledge here and now, then why should they rely on oral tradition? But if we disregard that, this forms at least, this is satisfactory as the first group of teachers in this period are the traditionalists who teach not on the basis of their own direct knowledge, but who rely upon an oral tradition, upon the tradition of sacred scriptures, which has come down through a lineage of teachers. And this will include the Brahmins who follow the Vedas. Then the next class also seems a little mixed up. There are some recluses and Brahmins who, entirely on the basis of mere faith, claim to teach the fundamentals of the holy life, again, on the basis of direct knowledge here and now. Such are the reasoners and investigators. The reasoners and investigators, these are the ones who use reason, pure logic, pure thought, or even empirical investigation as a starting point for reasoning and reflection. So what I find puzzling in the second category is, why does the text say that they rely entirely on the basis of mere faith? It seems mere faith belongs in the first category, to be characteristic of the Brahmins who accept an oral tradition. Why do you accept an oral tradition as being true? Because one has faith in it, one believes it. In the case of the rationalist, the investigator, he doesn't rely on faith, but he uses his reasoning and reflection to deduce truth. That seems unlikely to me. Because usually one places faith either in another teacher as an authority or in some transmission of sacred texts as being true. So I find this to be almost contradictory or paradoxical. But I prefer to leave aside the the phrase which says that they rely entirely on the basis of mere faith, and to instead emphasize that they rely upon reasoning and investigation, since this fits more appropriately the categories of teachers during this period who are rivals to the Buddha. Then the Buddha brings in the third class. There are some recluses and Brahmins who, having directly known the Dhamma for themselves, or having directly known the truth for themselves, among things not heard before, claim to teach the fundamentals of the holy life after having reached the consummation and perfection of direct knowledge here and now. Then the Buddha says, I, Bharadvaja, I am one of those recluses and Brahmins who claim to teach the fundamentals of the holy life, having directly known the Dhamma for themselves. So in other words, the Buddha doesn't rely upon oral tradition. He doesn't rely upon pure reason, but he relies upon direct experience, direct knowledge. Knowing and seeing the truth for oneself. And so, coming back to the sutta that we're discussing, the young Brahmin Kapattika, what class of these three would he fall into? What class? The first, he is a traditionalist. And so now the Buddha says that since none of the Brahmins, I'm back to page 780, since none of the Brahmins see the truth of the Vedic teaching for themselves, what do you think? Doesn't the faith of the Brahmins turn out to be groundless? In other words, they are just placing blind faith in these sacred texts, the hymns of the Vedas, and they're taking a dogmatic attitude, declaring only this is truth, anything else is false, but they don't have any real personal knowledge, personal direct experience of this for themselves. So all they have is a kind of empty faith. And then the Brahmin Kapattika tries to argue with the Buddha, and he says, the Brahmins honor this not only out of faith, they also honor it as oral tradition. That is, this is not just something that the Brahmins individually believe, but I think here he's trying to emphasize that this is a sacred tradition, something which has come down for generation after generation, maybe for thousands of years. And so since it's been preserved as sacred truth for such a long time, and the scriptures, though they would have been recited with such devotion, preserved flawlessly, word for word, syllable for syllable, for this reason they must be truth. What the Buddha now presents his argument, he says, or he continues his argument, he says, first you took your stand on faith, now you speak of oral tradition. And now the Buddha is going to introduce five things which I described in the outline. I say five things which are inadequate bases for truth claims. What are these five? And then the Buddha says there are five things that may turn out in two different ways here and now. Okay, so what are these five? There's faith. This is saddha. Faith or belief. Generally faith based upon emotion and devotion towards a religious teacher or a set of sacred scriptures. Then there is what's called approval here. The Pali word ruchi might also have been translated personal preference. That is, you might meet a particular religious teaching, spiritual teaching, and you feel just some, without any rational grounds, but you feel some liking to it, some disposition towards it. You have some, you approve of it, you like it, it impresses you. And so then you place confidence in that and accept that just because you like it. The third ground is oral tradition. These would be like the sacred scriptures that have come down from ancient times, regarded as infallible sources of truth. A fourth is here translated reason cogitation, which means inferential reasoning. You begin with certain things that you might see as evident truths, then you start reasoning from those truths and arrive at conclusions which might be quite remote from the empirical facts that one begins with. Many of the philosophical systems that developed in the history of Western philosophy would fall within this category. A thinker begins by saying, I'm not going to rely upon any revealed truths, any sources of authority, like René Descartes, but just begin with what is clear and self-evident. So he starts with the facts of bare experience, and then by reasoning and deducing from the facts of experience, one winds up proving the existence of an almighty God, proving the existence of an eternal soul, proving this, proving that. Then another thinker will come along, starting with the same facts, start reasoning from them, and then construct another system which is completely different from the first one. And each one, the adherent of each one, is arguing with the other one, saying that the facts prove it. My system is true, yours is false. But in fact, each system is constructed through reflection, through thought. Okay, and then the fifth basis for truth claims is what is called, in Pali, it's a rather complicated expression, ditti nijana kanti, which here is translated reflective acceptance of a view. What this seems to mean is that when you become acquainted with a particular religious or philosophical view, you ponder it, reflect upon it, and then as a result of reflecting, it seems to be convincing, to be cogent. And so you then place trust in it and think, ah, this might be true. Then after thinking it might be true, then once you start following that teaching, you become more and more convinced that it's true until you're ready to declare, yes, this is true. And so we have these five grounds put forward as a basis for claims to truth, on the basis of which people will claim this is the truth. Anything else is, or anything contrary to this is false. And now this is the way the Buddha handles these five claims, or five grounds for truth claims. He says these five things may turn out in two different ways here and now. First of all, taking faith. Something might be fully accepted out of faith. You have utter faith in this doctrine. You believe it. It seems absolutely convincing. And so you're ready to lay down your life for it. And yet, even though you believe it completely, still, it may be It may be true, actually. And just because one has faith in it doesn't mean that it's false. It might be true, but yet it might also be false, empty, hollow. In other words, the fact that one has faith, even very strong and powerful faith, doesn't mean that it's true. And then there might be something else which nobody believes, nobody accepts out of faith. And yet this might be true. This might be unmistakable. Again, you might have a liking for some teaching, a preference for it. And the preference might be very strong. But the fact that you prefer this teaching, that it appeals to you, doesn't make it true. Because even though you prefer it so much over other teaching, but what you prefer might be false. And the teachings that you don't like, that you don't lean to, they might be true. Again, some scripture, some teaching embedded in a scripture might come down from generation to generation, perfectly transmitted. There's been no meddling with the text. Each generation of reciters has recited it perfectly, following the example of his teachers. So, for example, the Vedas that are recited now will be exactly the way they were recited 1,000 years ago, 2,000 years ago. And yet the fact that it's perfectly transmitted through this lineage of teachers doesn't make it true. And something which has not been orally transmitted, which nobody believes, that might be true. Again, one might think out a system with very razor-sharp logic. One might have a system of perfect deductive logic, beginning with certain premises. Then each step in the system follows with ironclad consistency from the premises. Like you remember what we learned in high school, Euclidean geometry. You begin with certain, what they call them, axioms. And then from the axioms, you deduce theorems. And you could put the steps of the theorem that lead up to prove the theorem. Step one, step two, step three, step four, till you come to the conclusion, quote erat demonstratum, thus it is demonstrated. And so and once you begin with these premises, the conclusions have to follow as an absolute matter of course. But then, I think it was the early 20th century, some mathematicians started questioning the premises of Euclidean geometry till they came up with other systems. You start by postulating other axioms, and then from that you can derive very different systems of geometry. And some of those other systems will actually be more faithful to actual lived concrete experience than Euclidean geometry, which presupposes a kind of ideal two-dimensional domain in which all of these figures and lines and points exist. And just, well, of course, mathematics is one example. Again, the example of philosophy, one has, like in the 19th century, Hegel came and devised his philosophical system based on his reasoning, thinking, okay, the history of philosophy now has pretty much reached its consummation. All of the history of philosophy has been unfolding till it's reached its full flowering in my system of philosophy. So now philosophy is at an end since I have fully developed my system. Everything is based upon irrefutable premises and unfolds with incontrovertible logic, one step leading to another. Then the next generation. Karl Marx came along and turned Hegel's philosophy on its head by starting with different premises. And then before long, Hegel's system, like a tower made of cards, you pull the bottom card out and the whole tower falls, collapses to the ground. Okay, so having a perfectly devised logical system, rationalistic system, is not a guarantee of truth. Okay, and then you have this reflection upon a view. Okay, you are exposed to a particular view. You reflect upon it very carefully, very thoroughly. But the fact that it seems convincing to you on reflection doesn't make it true. It might be true, but it might also be false or mistaken. And so the Buddha says, he draws this conclusion, that it is not proper for a wise man who preserves truth to come to the definite conclusion, only this is true, anything else is wrong. So here the Buddha has introduced one of the important ideas of the sutta now, the preservation of truth. In other words, what kind of approach one has to take in order to be faithful to the truth, not to transgress the limits of truth by making bold, invalid, let's say bold, audacious, confident, but invalid claims. What kind of statements can we make that are properly cautious and properly respectful of the boundaries of truth? And the Buddha... So the student, the Brahmin student, raises that question, in what way is there the preservation of truth? How does one preserve truth? We ask Master Gotama about the preservation of truth. And the Buddha replies, if a person has faith, he preserves truth when he says, my faith is thus. But he does not yet come to the definite conclusion, only this is true, anything else is wrong. In this way, there is the preservation of truth. In this way, one preserves truth. In this way, we describe the preservation of truth. In other words, you have faith in something, and that faith might be true. As a Buddhist, I have faith in the Buddha, faith in the Dharma, in the teaching. But I can't step out and say, I know this, that the Buddha is fully, perfectly enlightened, that the Dharma, the teaching, is completely true. But I have faith that it is true. And the fact that one has faith in something doesn't mean that it can never be validated, that it has to remain forever a matter of faith. But when one has faith without direct knowledge, then to preserve truth, one could only say, this is my faith, this is what I believe. But don't make dogmatic claims that because I believe this, it must be true, and anything else false. And if one speaks in that way, then one is respecting the boundaries of truth. One is preserving, protecting truth. Similarly, if one has a preference or liking for something, a teaching. One says, I prefer this teaching, I like this teaching. But don't use your preference, your liking, as a basis for making truth claims. Therefore, it's true. Or if something comes in an oral tradition, or the Buddhists say Buddhism now, it comes to us not in an oral tradition, but in a written tradition. But still, the text we have here faithfully reproduce an oral tradition which would have gone back 2,000 years. So the fact that these things are written in the Buddhist texts, and we could see that they are also found in texts that go back 2,000 years, just means that the texts have been well transmitted. It doesn't mean that we can claim that what's said in the text must be true. Similarly, when one reasons about something and arrives at a conclusion from reasoning, of course, there are certain types of reasoning that are absolutely, that lead to compelling conclusions, necessary conclusions, but that's usually generally purely logical reasoning. When you start reasoning from observed facts, then there's scope for error. And then when one ponders a view, reflects upon a view, and then accepts that view by pondering it, one shouldn't come to the conclusion, therefore, this is the right view, the correct view. Any other view is wrong. All you can say, if you respect truth, is that I've reflected on this view. The view seems to me to be correct. And so this is the view I accept. Okay, so now the Buddha says, in this way, there is the preservation of truth. In this way, one preserves truth. In this way, we describe the preservation of truth. But as yet, there is no discovery of truth. And at this point, we'll stop the discussion and continue with the sutta next time. But I find this to be really such a remarkable passage that we've just discussed, considering that this is 2,500 years old, and when we consider the history of religions, how so many religious teachers say, I am the prophet, or I am the sage, the seer. This is the truth. And everybody else has to believe it, and all other teachings false, let's commit them to the flames. Then generations later, his followers saying, he is the one who knew the truth. Nobody else can know the truth, but we receive the truth from him, so we have to follow it and accept it. But the Buddha just so cautious, so careful, so precise in making these distinctions. Yeah.
He makes the distinction that he still professes that his teaching is
the truth. Yeah. But he will teach the way to realize the truth. We see that next time. Any questions or any comments? Yeah. Bharadvaja. This was, it probably still is, a Brahmin family name. Bharadvaja. Dvaja is, Bhara is weight, Dvaja is standard, flag. I don't know the significance of the two words combined. Yeah.
Earlier in the Sutta, talking about various non-refuge
temples. Yeah, yeah.
How do we understand refuge in the Brahma Bhava? Who is the Brahma?
Say the last sentence again.
You're talking about these various Brahmins.
Yeah.
But they're not followers of the Buddha.
Actually, this Brahmin, Pokarasati, did become a follower of the Buddha. No, they remain Brahmins. They remain Brahmins, but while remaining Brahmins, they don't become monks. They remain Brahmins, but they become, you see, lay followers of the Buddha. They go take the three refuges and they become upasikas. I would think if they were if the Brahmins do become Buddhists, then they can no longer.
I think it would interfere with some of their Brahmanic
they could no longer promote animal sacrifice. There would be a conflict there. But from the evidence of the text, particularly one sees this in the some suttas in the beginning of the Digha Nikaya, and also in the Majjhima Nikaya, Brahmins do go for refuge to the Buddha. What's interesting also is that a kind of sociological study has been done in a book in the library, Uma Chakravarti, The Social Dimensions of Early Buddhism. She has a table in which she's tabulated the caste affiliations of the Buddhist disciples who are mentioned most often in the Buddhist texts, in cases where their caste identity is given. And she finds that I think the greatest number of those who became prominent Buddhist monks were former Brahmins. Sariputta, Moggallana were Brahmins, Mahakasapa was a Brahmin, Mahakachayana was Brahmin, quite a number. And the greatest number of lay followers would have been probably from the Vaishya caste, a caste of merchants, agriculturalists, but not that many, according to her findings, from the Vaishya caste got ordained. Maybe they were too busy earning money. And these kings, King Kosala, or King Pasenadi of Kosala, did become a follower of the Buddha. In fact, there's a whole selection of short suttas in which King Pasenadi consults with the Buddha. It comes in the Samyutta Nikaya. And King Bimbisara actually befriended the Buddha before the Buddha reached his enlightenment, while he was still a seeker of enlightenment. And King Bimbisara was very impressed. He saw the Buddha wandering for alms, and he was so impressed with him that he came to visit him, and he tried to appeal to the Bodhisattva to give up his quest for enlightenment and to become a co-ruler with him. But the Buddha insisted that he was going to continue on this quest, and then King Bimbisara said, "Then please promise me that after you achieve enlightenment, come back to my kingdom and teach me the truth that you realize." And then the Buddha fulfilled that promise, and King Bimbisara became a Sotapanna, a stream enterer, and he donated to the Buddha the famous bamboo grove in outside Rajagir, Rajagaha. Any further questions? Yes, Suki. Yeah. Actually, that's a very good point. Yeah. That's a very, very good point. That's a very good point. Yeah, I would agree with that. That just experience itself is not really inadequate criterion of truth, since one can, if one wants to believe something, one can generate the experience which will seem to confirm it. For example, like various Christians say that they can speak with tongues. They call this phenomenon speaking with tongues, where you utter sounds and you're supposedly speaking other languages. And so then people, maybe they begin skeptically, but they see these devotees practicing this, they go into a kind of semi-trance state, and then they start speaking ga-ga-gu-ga-ga-ga-ga-ga-ga, and they're convinced that they're speaking intelligible words. And so a person might get then emotionally carried away and start imitating, and then before long, he's going gu-ga-ga-ga-ga-la-gu-la-ga-la-ga-la-gu-la-gat, and he thinks, I'm speaking in tongues too, so therefore this is a real genuine phenomenon, that one is able, just through the infusion of the divine spirit, to speak in foreign languages. Or else more seriously, and this is a puzzling matter, okay, a Hindu meditator a Vedantic meditator will begin with the supposition of an eternal absolute self and then go into very deep meditation and then come out of that meditative state and said, within that meditative experience, I realize the truth of the Atman, of the universal self. And the Christian meditator will begin with the supposition, of course, that there's an all-powerful creator God, and then will direct a meditative love towards God. Oh, my beloved God, reveal your presence to me, reveal it. And then he'll have a very deep, powerful meditative experience, which he interprets as being a kind of self-disclosure of God, an infusion with divine grace. And there are many Christian mystics who have had quite astonishing experiences, which are not just sheer delusion, but convinces them that they have had direct communion or union with the Almighty God. And then a Buddhist meditator in meditation claims to see the truth of anatta or non-self. So each one begins with certain premises, and then the unfolding contemplative experience seems to confirm those premises. How is one able to differentiate? One is being in touch with absolute truth, with what is actual truth, and the other is just realizing things which flow from the original premises or presuppositions. Excuse me? Yeah, sanya would be a quite important ingredient in that experience. Sanya is perception. But also when one has a realization of, say, impermanence, it's also called anicca sanya, the perception of impermanence. Okay, anyway, are there any... But it's a good point that it's not enough just to have a very powerful, overwhelming experience, but it should be experience of Dhamma, of what is true, actual. Any further questions? Okay, then we will stop for this evening and then continue. Next week we will complete the sutta. Okay. Share the merit with with the Dhamma protecting devas whose existence I accept through faith. Akasa ta chabumata deva naga mahitika punyantang anumoditva chirang rakantu sasanang. Akasa ta chabumata deva naga mahitika